Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And we're wrapping up on the Whiskey Rebellion. I thought we'd wrap up yesterday, but that's okay. We got Tammy with us as well as Sean to kind of cover the last couple of paragraphs. But before we do, Sean and I started going down this path of, you know, how we were advancing as a nation. And as Tammy has witnessed firsthand, my jumping into this needle, this minuscule hole, like what you would see, that thread hole on the end of a needle. And next thing you know, I'm swimming in it like it's an Olympic pool. I'm just trying to be funny. Well, so welcome back, both of you. So where we kind of left off, we started talking about this globalism. And we talked about how America had become the dominant force of global corporations. As we look at Britain, and as a matter of fact, if we back up prior to the revolution, there were some very powerful companies that were created. The East Indies and the West Indies Trading Companies were two companies that were created. The East Indies Trading Company was a very powerful company, and it was a government with war capability. And so, you know, when we look at these corporations that were in England creating, you know, these fine chinas and these little things like that, those weren't a part of the British mercantile system. They were just within it. And so these, you know, like Waterford, Wedgwood, and on and on, we look at these British or these UK, I'll say, crafts, corporations, and so forth, where they weren't this big industrial mercantile, they weren't this big, I'll say national or international corporations. What was happening was there were some British corporations that were existing, but in Europe, it was like Germany that was bringing, you know, chemicals and those types of things, because they had more resources. So the other European nations had, you know, a little here and there play in bringing commodities into a commodity market. Most everything started shifting to America in the early 1800s. I've kind of jumped into this other side swimming pool. There's a good story about the DuPont rising to power. There was a British company that was selling borax, just like DuPont. DuPont, one of their primary products that they were selling in commodity was borax. And so this, and I forget, I know that there's a good book that talks about these early companies of America that really started flexing their muscles. This was before the federal government had unconstitutionally seized full control over corporations and regulated commerce within the states, well before this. So DuPont was playing this, you know, this commodities game, and they were undercutting everybody in Europe because they could, and they were still making a profit. And this British company was, not British, this German company thought that they would bring them to their knees, so they started bringing in product that was cheaper than what DuPont could sell in America. In other words, they were directly competing in America with DuPont. So do either of you know what DuPont did in response to them flooding the U.S. market with this ultra-cheap borax?
I do not.
Sean, any ideas?
No, sir.
They bought it up. Why not? If it's cheaper than what they could bring to the market at their own cost, they bought it up and just shipped it back out. Instead of having to worry to get borax to the ports, it was already sitting at the ports. They would buy it up and then send it back to them. And so what ended up happening was this German company absolutely, you know, caved. I mean, they took a loss in doing that, and they took such a loss that they had to kind of lick their wounds, and they had to realize that, you know, DuPont was one, smarter than they were, or two, you know, they had the depth to be able to respond to what they were doing. And they underestimated them, and DuPont became a global provider in these, I'll just say, these chemicals and these, I'll just call them chemicals, compounds, what have you, and, you know, soaps, industrial cleansers, those types of things, to where DuPont became a heavy hitter. And other companies around the United States were rising up to power long before the federal government had seized these controls. Procter & Gamble was another company. And as a matter of fact, Procter & Gamble was attacked in America by the unions. They were one of the few large corporations that were functioning that was really, you know, they were a very powerful corporation. When they got to power, this was like the early 1800s, not early, about mid-1800s, when they were so prominent that the union started attacking them. And what they did, Procter & Gamble did, was they actually started profit sharing, because it really wasn't about profits for them. It was about dominance in the market. And so they started actually giving everybody extra pay as a profit sharing at the end of the year. And it was really, really nice, because, you know, it's like Christmas bonuses, because by this point in time, we'd been concocted and, you know, manipulated into, you know, the commercialism of Christmas, and having a year-end bonus was great because you could spend more money on Christmas. So anyway, Procter & Gamble basically was keeping the union from being able to penetrate them, but they still ended up losing because the people wanted to see a guarantee of an income instead of profit sharing. In other words, they didn't realize, so this is how the unions were insidious. They basically told the people they were better off having a constant income instead of having these big windfalls at the end of the year. And so as they ended up, penetrating into Procter & Gamble and kind of taking their position as a union in labor in Procter & Gamble, what ended up happening was it drove Procter & Gamble's profits down. They ended up having to do reductions, so people ended up losing their jobs instead of this constant growth under this free market concept. When all of a sudden labor was no longer free for Procter & Gamble, or I should say they had to do bargaining with collectivized bargaining and that type of stuff, it literally drove their profits down. And all of a sudden, the consequences of this bad decision by the employees, because they were bedazzled by the union, that life would just be better. They wouldn't have to work as hard. In other words, their productivity could go down. They would get paid just as good, if not better. And that was a lie. So there's... Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, it always is a lie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we got these two contrasts, right? But I want everybody to understand, and I covered this a long time ago, that globalism under the auspices of corporations, world monarchs, international independent monarchs, because that's exactly what these corporations are. These corporations are almost like nations. And these corporations have, I'll just say, this power with government, because they've created these alliances with government. Never mind that phone. That phone isn't important. Pay no attention to the phone. Anyway, I'm sorry. So the whole point here is that in England, they didn't have major corporations like what was coming out of America with Standard Oil, with DuPont, Procter & Gamble. I mean, America was manufacturing. As the Industrial Revolution really started opening up, we had the land, we had the resources to compete with the world, and we had the labor to do it as well. We had people that were more than willing to start jumping into these factories and these mills and what have you. About a century before we came to prominence, Britain had already risen to prominence within their sphere. In other words, they, in their little sphere of Europe, they had their prominence. And they, Britain was really driving, they were considered the big companies, but they paled in comparison to what was coming out of America because of the volume and everything else we were able to bring in. The fact of the matter is that in the early 1800s, there was this awakening of this spirit, this undertone within the culture of England, that England was anointed by God. Now, Sean, you talked about the crown and the succession of anointing the king, the monarch of England. There's a stone or something. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, there was a stone that supposedly came from the Middle East, and it passed through different places, Scotland and Ireland, and they used it to coronate their king. And then when during the first War of Scottish Independence in 1296, King Edward of England seized the stone and brought it to Westminster Abbey, had it built into a coronation chair where it's been used ever since in the coronation of English and later British monarchs.
Okay. All right. So
it's called Jacob's Pillar Stone.
Okay. Therefore, it's probably from an edifice that their Jacob's Pillar was there. I don't know. I have no idea. I have to do the research. And one of the things that I have to admit, you know, when I usually don't care about a long, long time ago, I'm speaking in sentence fragments, so let me give you the background. In the early 1990s, I started getting exposed to conspiracy theories, and I really started diving into this, and it was very consuming for me. And what I mean by that is I, you know, undisclosed these facts and these other facts and contradictory facts, and it was just this maze. And I found that it had consumed me for several years to a point where it was literally driving me. And I realized at that point, I was more possessed by the conspiracies than I was by cognitive powers of what do we need to do. And I realized that I was more enthralled with helping people see and understand the conspiracies than helping people see and understand the way past these conspiracies, way past all of the corruption and everything else of what we need to do to reclaim the Republic. And I felt that that was far more important than wasting time in helping everybody understand that we're all doomed because it's a conspiracy. There's no hope in selling conspiracies. There's no hope in selling doom, right? There is hope when we actually show people that the Constitution gives us everything we need, that we have what we need to actually take this government back. We can do this, folks. We have hope. And I like that message far better than anything else that ever, you know, has ever come across the table for me. And so I kind of started digging on this. One of the things I learned, though, was how to do the research. And so as I started, I realized that when I start something, and I'm bringing this up because this has a lot to do with the Federalist paper being the poisonous pill. One of the things that I'm doing is that I'm doing the depth of research, because when I write something, I want to make sure that I'm writing it where it cannot be academically refuted. In other words, I want to make sure that I have all the primary source documents that they all say, and, you know, and I can prove that they all say what I am telling you. Because when you do that, folks, when you have the irrefutable argument, it's the truth. It's the foundation. And you can't knock anybody off of the foundation. You can't knock a building over. You have to destroy the building by destroying the foundation. Therefore, as I was going down this path, and as I've done this so many times before, you run across something that is, oh, you know what? And one of the things I just ran across that was one of those, you know what, you know, circumstances just this past week, I was laying out in the argument, because I'm having to help people understand, when you're making a legal argument, and especially when it comes to the Constitution, we have to go by these artifacts that are primary source documents. If you don't know what a primary source document is, a primary source document is a document that was created by the event itself. Now, a good case in point with the Constitution, we have a couple of primary source documents. There's two. There's two types, I should say. There are the documents that were created during the Constitutional Convention. In other words, the formal notes. The Secretary took notes of what they said, what they did. The only problem is, how good were those notes? Well, come to find out that William Jackson, who was the Secretary, who was a plant by Hamilton, and actually made these notes. What's coming out now is that there's, you know, this move of creating greater credibility to Jackson's notes. When way back, mid-1800s, a guy by the name of, I think, Farrand or something like that, compiled all of the notes together into a single document. And he really belittled Jackson's notes. He basically said, this guy was junior league. He did marginal work. For somebody that was getting paid to do this, he didn't do his job. In contrast, Madison was the guy that had the best and most thorough notes and covered more of the pertinent and relevant information regarding the convention. Well, for the past half century, century, or at least during my lifetime, Madison's notes were the gold standard. Well, now there's a pushback. Oh, well, you know, you got to look at Jackson's notes. So guess what? Yours truly is now pulling up Jackson's notes so that I can have them isolated and compare and contrast between what Jackson covered, when he covered it, and the detail that he covered, in contrast to Madison, especially on the content. So you got to do these types of things if you're really going to lay it out there, because you need to be able to disclose, you know, why Jackson's argument. I can't rely on somebody's editorializing, so like Farrand or whatever this guy's name was, you know, and how he kind of belittled Jackson. I can't rely on that. I actually have to go on firsthand knowledge by reading these things so that I can do this. So anyway, as I started looking at the history of Britain, both the economic, the legal history as it evolved, because that became a huge endeavor. And I have not done the full due diligence, because my job isn't to give you the full history. I need to be able to give you the facts of the evolution of how history went from a state within the Roman Empire to become a state within the Roman Catholic Empire, to becoming a state within Europe underneath the different empires. And the last empire before Britain was Spain. And so with the Spanish Empire basically being defeated by Britain, Britain became the next empire. And, you know, so we cover all of these types of things. As in doing this, we've kind of have covered, or at least I've disclosed to everybody, the, you know, this creation of this monarchical theocracy of England. Another little antidote, or another little artifact that's out there, is this concept that Britain had been prepared, and they took it upon themselves to be that nation that would usher in the last days that the Bible talks about. And if you really look at Revelations, now help me out here, Sean. There are 10 heads and 3 heads that rule the 10, something like that.
Yes, sir.
And the one that rules the 3.
Yes, sir.
And I believe that one head that rules the 3 is Britain. And I believe Britain didn't look at itself as the monster, this evil thing of this headed beast, right? I don't think they looked at that. But I think that they looked at themselves as this righteous entity that was going to pave the way for the creation of the state of Israel. And so there was a song written.
What do you know?
What do you know? So there was a song written about Jerusalem. And the song about Jerusalem was really pointing to, how Britain had become the New Jerusalem and how Britain has kind of gone down this aside by being taken over by these satanic mills, that the time must come when we put aside the satanic mills and do what God wants us to do with we've been foreordained. So this is the song Jerusalem. And I could pull up the, you know, the song itself and play it. But I think what's probably more, you know, appropriate at this point is really just pull up the lyrics so that we can kind of look at what are in those lyrics. And let me see here. What are the lyrics of the hymn Jerusalem? And so this, hopefully this will pull it up so we can, I just want to walk through this. Because, folks, when was this written, Sean? You pulled this up, I think, before.
1804.
And it became formalized, I think, in the early 1900s.
Correct.
Okay. Oh, come on, come on, come on, come on. I can't believe.
I put it in the chat if you can get that.
Yeah, I think I've got it. Hopefully it's coming up. What are the lyrics? Here, and here they are right here. And did those feet in ancient time wake upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? Now, there's been folklore, and as a matter of fact, throughout Christendom, there has been accounts that Christ had visited lots of nations. And I think there's even accounts that he even went to China or into the Orient, because there was this point in time where Christ traveled. And he literally traveled before he came back and started his ministry. And so they are capitalizing here. They believe that he traveled there. As a matter of fact, there's a rose tree. Have you heard of the rose tree that's 2,000 years old that's still growing in England?
No, sir.
Okay, so you may want to look that one up, because I'm not sure if it's dead or not yet, but I remember watching a documentary that points the origins of this tree goes back to the time when this claimed Christ child, a young man, came to Britain and planted this rose tree. So, moving on, there's all this folklore that they started creating. Well, they started looking at themselves at the turn of the century, going into the early 1800s, as this responsibility. Now that the fact that they took on this blow from the colonies, where we just beat them and left them. And so, you know, what is British's role in the future of Christendom in the world as the empire of the world? And so that's why I said, you know, did the Lamb of God, and was the Holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And the next verse is, and did the countenance divine shrine upon our clouded hills, and was Jerusalem builded there, or builded here among these dark satanic mills? So in other words, did Jerusalem actually get built amongst these corporations that were becoming factories of slavery to the good British people? Because that's what they were talking about here. They saw this industrial revolution becoming this evil revolution taking over the world. Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear, O clouds unfold. Bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and present land. So they believe that the new Jerusalem, according to the Bible, talks about a new Jerusalem. They believe it's there. And so this became this folklore, and this is why this is still to this day. As a matter of fact, we're going into break. There are plenty of movies and comedies where they use Jerusalem as this wake up. I don't want to go into the break, so let me just say this. When we come back to the break, we'll talk about how significance this has really played in the culture of Britain or the British people. So we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so right at the time this concept started growing legs and started becoming this this folklore of Britain, right about that same time here in America, the concept, because I haven't done the Christmas show yet, but the concept of Christmas coming from America, and just to be clear here, the reason it came from America was because of corporations. In other words, it was the selling of Christmas and the corporations of monetizing the gift giving and so forth that ended up becoming the end game. And in today's, you know, as we look at it today, it's not even about giving gifts in the name of Christ. It's about the holiday season and making it all about, you know, receiving and giving gifts, monetary. It's the commercializing of the birth of Christ, when it was literally originally the selling of a pagan holiday to entwine it, or to basically adjoin it to some arbitrary point in Christ's life, such as his birth, which is what stuck. Now, I would basically, if you've never heard the annual Christmas message, I play it on Christmas Eve and Christmas, and I'll come up with a new one, and we'll cover that, and I'll have Sean and Tammy help do that show. Because going through the history of all of this, I think helps everybody kind of see how we kind of inherited this winter solstice celebration from from England, because we were the descendants of England. I mean, we all migrated away from, out of all of the colonies, almost 80%, if not greater, were English. There were very few that were in the colonies that did not migrate from England. So in other words, we were pretty much the same people, but we were just torn by religion and labor and these other factions. And this whole concept of this religious paradigm was being kind of folded into America to kind of bring us together. And that bringing us together was Christmas. And in England, it was about this, their duty to become Jerusalem. Do you see? You see how that language and the lyrics kind of lay that out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
I was wondering if somebody named Balfour wrote it.
Okay. So with that, we can see how England started becoming the prominent force in the global manipulation, because how did Israel come to be? Israel came to be because of England. England was the one that was basically taking care of and finishing off the Ottoman Empire control over the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire was still in control at the end of the 1800s. The beginning of the 1900s and World War I and then World War II sealed the deal. You see my point? And so by this point in time, mm-hmm. After World War II, the Allies had basically wiped out these bad alliances, and now Israel was brought to the forefront under this, the UN and this big globalist movement that the United States and Britain were working together on. Britain brought us Israel, and the United States brought the world the United Nations. And at this point in time, America was the great, I'll just say, the great capital of corporatism, global corporatism. And it wasn't until after we went in back into Germany and into Japan and built corporatism in those nations, did they even become competitive with us, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the dominance that we had. We had an industrial machine that when we focused our entire nation in war fighting, we took on the world, practically. Now, there's a lot of people that would correct me regarding World War II, that Russia was an important cog in this fight. I don't want to marginalize Russia, but bottom line is Russia, you know, was just a large force to basically occupy Germany on their eastern flank. I don't think Russia was playing any serious endeavor at all in the Pacific theater or anything like that, where we were basically doing everything else with alliances and so forth. Nevertheless, all of these things came to closure by World War II so that the globalist plan could be laid out and put into place by the UN, Israel, and now we're seeing where we are today. And I think it all kind of plays out, but bottom line, the corporations of the world, these major corporations that had arisen, and I'll say the old money in corporations, are, you know, those of like Walmart, those of, you know, Procter & Gamble, Standard Oil, these corporations that have been around well over a century, where these new corporations such as Apple, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, that have just been created, have, you know, been brought to the forefront as these new dominators because they had risen to such a mighty level of power, surpassing most all of these other old corporations combined. And if you really start looking at the world corporations, who has the most amount of money? Almost all of them. Almost, I mean, there may be other nations that have a few. China is actually coming in as a player of corporations, but they're all state corporations. Don't be fooled. They may have a name in front of them, but it is a communist state, and there is no such thing as private enterprise. They just put a person in front that, oh, that's the person that we're calling the corporate chief, and he's getting credit for it. And so China,
right.
China's only come to play because, folks, we have given them everything. We've gave them our technology. We made them the most favored nation status. We have poured billions of dollars into China regularly to build them to this point so that they could be the formidable enemy that could put the fear of God in America.
Or were they the model for what they want America to be?
Well, I think a little both. I think that was probably both, because they have been integrating this new form of, you know, the 15-minute cities, all of these types of things they've been doing in China, because they can get away with those types of things. They can get away with that level of tyranny. So that's one of the things that helps scare everybody. Oh, you know, that could come here. Yeah, it can. As a matter of fact, it probably will come here, but it will come, I believe it'll come from American hands. I don't think it'll really come from China's hands. I don't think, and the reason why I say this is because even though we see China as a huge threat, China is at the point of capitulation. I believe by 2030 or in the early 2030s, within the next 5, 6, 10 years, China won't have war-fighting hands anymore. Most of their people will be, they'll be old and dying because they stopped. They were at a zero growth. They were in a negative growth point by only allowing one child per family. And so now, pardon me, go ahead.
Yeah, you're right.
And so India's falling into that same problem too. In other words, they looked at their strategic advantage, but they never actualized their strategic advantage soon enough to where they could actually, you know, bring in the hordes and hordes that they were claiming. The only nation out there, evil nation, that has really been able to maintain its size and still has a commitment to that same size in the next 20 years is Russia. Because Russia didn't create those kinds of limitations. What Russia did was, as the people had made babies, they brought the babies into the state and the state took care of them. The state was the parents. Because they needed bodies. They had all sorts of resources where China had too many bodies. And so the paradigms were definitely different under the two. But you're right. I think China was a very integral part in integration and so forth. So back to this whole thing of where America is at this point with the Whiskey Rebellion. We were just getting our feet wet in using the Constitution. And the fact of the matter is, even though, because I said this yesterday, even though they did things that they shouldn't have done, they did it because, right, wrong, or indifferent, they didn't want to be disrespectful to George, they, you know, the president, they didn't, there were these little inhibitors, but it wasn't really egregious stuff. And what they ended up doing with this act, it violates the Constitution. But in a strategic sense, we do need to have an amendment. But my fear is that once we have an amendment, it becomes more permanent, and the language of that amendment becomes a much greater threat. Because if we give too much power to the president, then we could really rue the day. And, you know, in other words, the president would have a great opportunity to become a true tyrant. So anyway, Let's kind of wrap up the Whiskey Rebellion, because I think we may have a minute or two left, you know, to get this show done, and we've got maybe a half a page to do. So try to keep GR out of the swimming pool, because it's not like I'm, you know, what are those swimmers that perform, what do they call those? A synchronized swimmer. I'm not a synchronized swimmer, you know. I'm not that entertaining. But anyway, let's pick up with Tammy. So in 1795, the Third Congress replaced the original statute with that part.
Okay,
go ahead.
Okay, so in 1795, the Third Congress replaced the original statute with the 1795 Militia Act, which removed or reduced several of the major checks on the president's authority to call forth the militia in times of insurrection. Among other things, the new act removed the requirement of giving an antecedent court order and removed the requirement to proclaim a dispersal before the militia is called out. Clearly, our founders envisioned that Congress owned the power to call out the militia, but in 1795, they permanently delegated that power to the president and authorized the president to act decisively, expeditiously, and unilaterally in times of military emergencies.
And yet, so that's my point. And yet, the Constitution still says contrary. They may have put it in an act, but if that act is not in pursuance to the Constitution, it is not a legitimate act. Okay? So that's why I've highlighted that one part. Okay, so kind of moving forward, go ahead, Sean, and read the next three little paragraphs going to the trial of treason. Go ahead. You're on mute, if you didn't know.
Sorry. Washington met first with the rebels, who assured him the militia was not needed and that order had been restored. Washington opted to retain the military option until proof of submission was apparent. The large and well-armed militia marched into western Pennsylvania and was met with angry citizens but little violence. When a rebel army didn't appear, the militia rounded up suspected rebels instead. However, the rebellion's instigators had already fled and the militia's prisoners weren't involved in the rebellion. They were marched to Philadelphia to stand trial regardless. Only two men were found guilty of treason and both were pardoned by Washington.
Okay, so there we have it. They were basically charged with treason for not following the legitimate constitutional law of taxation. Now, if we actually, you know, if you look at protests, if you look at petitions and so forth, if we started holding the government accountable to things they don't have the authority to do, then this, this is what unites people. The problem here was that these people out in Western Pennsylvania, out in the Ohio Valley, technically, they were in a territory that wasn't to be taxed, or at least they didn't have the apportionment tax. So they weren't under that. And as I look at, why did these people just become rebel rousers? Well, we saw some disparities with the whiskey tax itself, that the more volume you did, the lower your tax was. And so there were these things that were unfair. Those things should have been redressed. They should have petitioned and said, hey, this is not fair. We're not paying this until it's a fair tax. Make it uniform at least, at a minimum, because the Constitution demanded that. But instead, these guys just, instead of pushing back and doing what was right, they pushed back on saying, we're not going to do this. And they were just completely resistant and went down that path. So to close out this, the last couple of lines, go ahead, Tammy, why the Whiskey Rebellion was important.
The federal response to the Whiskey Rebellion was widely believed to be a critical test of federal authority, one that Washington's fledgling government met with success. The whiskey tax that inspired the rebellion remained in effect until 1802. Under the leadership of President Thomas Jefferson and the Republican Party, which, like many citizens, opposed Hamilton's Federalist tax policies, the tax was repealed after continuing to be almost impossible to collect.
Right. And so it wasn't until, it wasn't really until the Prohibition movement and modern technologies of refrigeration boxes, ice boxes and those types of things started becoming more of a standard and a convenience. I mean, if you really look at America today, in the 50s, very few homes had air conditioning. Today, almost every home is outfitted with enough air conditioning, in contrast to other nations of the world where they still hardly have any air conditioning throughout the populace of the countries. In other words, what we have as luxuries become standards in America. It's just, they're like staples. And back in those days, alcohol was a staple. I can't emphasize this anymore than it is. This is how people received their sustenance, their nourishment in the winter months, was these, I'll call them mild grain alcohol, these distilled liquors. They weren't 80 proof. They were probably 30, 40 proof. It still get you good buzz. I mean, I don't know. I think what is beer? Something like 10 or 12 proof, right? Sean, I mean,
more like 4.
Why, Sean? Are you insinuating something, my friend?
No. I'm just saying because I don't know what the proofs are of beer, wine, and those things, but I do know where they actually start labeling the proof is usually somewhere around 40%, 40 proof, I should say, 20%. Right, because it's double, the proof is double what the percentage really is, right? If it's 40 proof, then it's 20% alcohol. And I think that when we look at how they made it stronger in alcohol, like vodka and so forth, where it's just a very high percentage of alcohol versus the grain itself, they moved the drinks away from being, nutritious providing to really more intoxicating. And I think with beer, I thought beer was around 10%.
And yeah, it's like 5 to 12%, okay. But it's usually measured in the, not in proof, but in percentage alcohol and by volume.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Like 6-point, 3-point beer. Because I remember in the military, when you go, I think it's Oklahoma, they have 3.2% beer or something like that.
Yep.
That's the highest alcohol level they can sell in certain places.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And so with wine, I think wine is somewhere between 8 and 20%, something like that.
Right.
Okay. So anyway,
in Germany,
what's that?
So 10%.
This is correct.
What's 10% in Germany?
I can definitely tell you about.
If you're 10 o'clock, you're 100% drunk.
Yes. Right? Okay. So I do also know that there are these different types of drafts or brews, like ales and so forth, where they're definitely defined as stronger, both in the grain as well as the alcohol content. And so the point is, back in those days, they enjoyed the alcohol content. They didn't have the patience to go through the extra distilling process to get, you know, more alcohol away from the fluids. It was really more of a wine. I mean, when you looked at the grain whiskey, it was really more of a grain wine than it was, even though it did get distilled. It was distilled. But
it was more for preservation, yes, and storage.
Right. And it was liquid grain, something, right, that could sit there on the shelf where the mice wouldn't get it because, you know, they didn't want the mice to get drunk. So they kept a cap on it. Anyway, I'll stop myself there. So, okay, so this kind of wraps up the Whiskey Rebellion. The whole point is that this is a beautiful snapshot of how they did everything they possibly could with reverence towards a very, very prominent man. Washington was... he was a demigod, at least, and at best, you know, a god amongst the Americans at that point in time. He was that well revered. I mean, he saved America. When, you know, people gave credit to man, I think most people, I think, that have the macro view, they realize that God saved him to save America. So anyway, the next document that we're going to dive into, and I kind of want to set the stage so we can get started on this, is the Kentucky Resolution of 1798. Now, this document, so I need to give you the history. This document was written and prepared by Thomas Jefferson. This was in response in 1798 to the Alien and Sedition Acts. This document, written by the vice president, the sitting vice president at the time, would have created a very ominous suspicion that the vice president himself may be guilty of sedition in holding the government accountable to the Constitution. Therefore, as a sitting president, sitting vice president, he wanted to make sure, this is probably the first time in American politics under the Constitution, we had a president that applied the concept of plausible deniability. Wanted to make sure that what he did couldn't be brought forward as, oh, hey, you know, he violated the law. He's a criminal. They wanted to make sure that this was done in such a way that it was not anybody's knowledge that he did this. As a matter of fact, this secret didn't even come out until around the time he died. It was one of the nation's best kept secrets who the author was of this. Now, this was done on November 10th, the Marine Corps birthday. So I always point those things out. Anyway, the following resolutions were adopted by the Kentucky legislature on November 10th as a protest against the Alien and Sedition Acts. You'll find this document on the Avalon Project, which is the Yale educational website for American history and so forth. And they were authored by Thomas Jefferson, but he did not make public the fact until years later. So I'm just repeating what they're saying here. Now, one of the things that you need to be aware of, if you do go to Avalon or you go to some of these websites will actually put a title on here, draft. The reason that they put this draft title on this resolution is because the ultimate final resolutions of Kentucky's final position comes out in the 1799 resolutions. They consider those the final. But these were not draft in the sense that these weren't done. They weren't publicized and disseminated to all of the states. I think they might have even went to the federal government. But the fact of the matter is that this was not a draft. A draft is technically something that doesn't formally go out. Is that not correct? I mean, Tammy, if you wrote a draft, would that be considered something for publication?
I mean, yeah, of course not.
Okay. And so when we look in context to the draft here, then we want to make sure that you understand that this is not a draft the way they're trying to label this academically. They just make the academic point that the final set of resolutions were their ultimate and final set. Even though they asked for these things, had Jefferson not wrote the response, and instead of writing new resolutions, instead of doing that, he just responded like Madison in a report, I believe that then their hands would have been tied, and they could not diminish the magnitude of this document by putting that draft label on it. When people look at that draft, oh, well, this means nothing. No, it means something because Kentucky actually took this and they passed this and they sent this out. Okay, so with that, we've got about 1 minute to kick things off, and so that's just not enough time. So when we come back tomorrow, we will dive into these first few resolutions. Now, one of the things I'll say now, and I'll probably say it again, the Kentucky resolutions performs a few different functions in the process of standing up to unconstitutional government. You have to do somewhat of an audit in identifying how these actions are in violation to the law. And that's exactly what Jefferson lays out and how he lays this out. So it's brilliant work that he did. And when Madison went to the Virginia resolutions, or she went to the Virginia legislature to help them write theirs, it was very clear that they were getting a lot of tutelage out of Madison in understanding what, why, hows, whens, and so forth that they needed to, you know, put into and what the language was. So, in other words, the Virginia legislature really had a benefit of working elbow to elbow with the great man, James Madison, where he literally explained to them and got them on board to understand what and why they were doing these things so that when they voted, they had no question this was the right thing to do. So with that, any final comments? We've basically got seconds left. Anything from either of you?
No, sir.
Well, with that, and with the long pause and a no, sir, and no, we will dive into these things tomorrow. These are the five critical documents that you'll find on the Academic Source Documents page. You need to understand these to understand what we have to do and how we reclaim the Republic. These are the foundational documents. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic review, they can enforce compliance to their Constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic review. Please read my argument for Republic review as well as my description of the Republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.